everybody. Welcome to Art Star Scene Radio on Radio Free Brooklyn. I am Face Boy. Face Girl, Catherine Dunn, could not be here this week. Maybe she's listening. We miss you. We love you. With me in the studio. It is too much. It's too damn much, isn't it?
It's a lot.
With me in the studio is my junior high school buddy, author, lawyer, black belt, don't fuck with him, Adam Smyre.
Hey everybody, Face, always a pleasure.
The following program contains material suitable for mature audiences only, and also the opinions expressed on Art Star Scene Radio are not necessarily the opinions of Radio Free Brooklyn. So I had mentioned to Adam at his wonderful reading at KGB Bar earlier this week that I had put together a list of, did you really do that? Because his book, Knucklehead, if you haven't read the book, spoiler alert, there's going to be some spoilers, but not nearly as many as I had planned. Because Adam lawyered up 30 minutes before the show. I get a text, we're going to need to talk about the scope, the direction. Well, I got to read that text. Can I read that text? I told you I was going to give you shit about this. This is a show about, can I at least read the text that you sent me?
And the part that says there too, I think is
so lawyered up.
I couldn't help it, man.
Okay. We do need to talk briefly about the scope / subject matter. The limits thereto, and why, so that we have a fun entertaining hour, and not an hour of this. There's some sort of weird, like
yes, well, yeah.
If you could get a little closer to the mic.
That may have happened. That text.
If I sent that text,
that's right. But we've straightened it out now, so prepare yourselves for a fun and entertaining hour.
Maybe. Okay. What inspired you to write Knucklehead? Let's get right into it.
Oh, what inspired me to write it? I think it's a question of what inspired me to just keep going with it, because I write, and so at some point I realized I had written enough pages that it was something. You know, you're a writer. You just you have an idea, you write, and then you kind of figure out what it is.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a short story, and then I wrote another short story, and then 2 years later, I was like, I guess I'm working on a novel.
Were you involved in any workshops? Did you have a writing guide?
A lot of guidance, a lot of community. I was lucky. My wife found an annual retreat for writers of color called Vona Voices Workshop, and it was perfect for me because I was tired of running short stories by friends and getting, it's great, I really like it, but do you think maybe, have you considered making the protagonist white? And so that happens enough that mm-hmm. a bunch of us got together and we workshop our stuff every year,
mm-hmm.
all over the country now. Writers of color are encouraged to find Vona Voices online and apply. And it'll change your life, change mine.
Tell me a bit about the process. I'll give you an example. When I'm just free writing, my process is to go down to the river, the Hudson River, which is only a short block from my house. Usually it's sunset because that is the time and the place that is most inspiring for me. I have a time and place that inspires me. So if it's just free writing, that's where I'm going to go. If I'm writing an article, for the Villager, I'm going to have like a 5-minute five minute interview with whoever owns whatever critter I'm writing about. And then I'm going to do a bunch of research on maybe their block, because I like to have a little history in the articles. And then I'll try to integrate it all together to make something that's entertaining. It's all light stuff when I'm doing NY Critters. So that's two different processes for two different types of writing. And so for you?
It's usually very unstructured. I write because I'm moved to. Working on a novel is a whole other thing. Best thing I can liken it to, not completely based on personal experience. I lost 30 pounds once, but writing a novel strikes me as what it must be like to lose 100 pounds because okay. It's just years and years of misery and discipline, but mostly misery and loneliness. It sucks. Don't do it. But I'm glad I did. There's a lot of, you know, structured writing time. There's a lot of getting up an hour earlier just to write. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of writing on a commuter bus going into San Francisco to work. And that was great. I had a little ancient netbook. It wasn't even a laptop. It was a netbook. And I was usually, I timed it right so that I could take my guts out, unpack them, spread them out, write about them, tuck them back in and go to work. There was one particular time, one particular part of the book. If someone reads it, they could probably guess which part it is. The bus pulled up at the terminal before I was ready. And I was just sitting in the back crying and everybody got off to go to their jobs. And I was just self-vivisected.
Of course.
Yeah. And tucked it all back in and went to work. But it's satisfying now. The weird thing about writing a novel is, for me, I was in the headspace I was writing about all the time.
I was going to ask you about that. That must have been a ride.
Yes, it was a ride. And it's crazy. I think I've seen other authors mention that. I did not expect that. I didn't see it coming. And there were periods of weeks or months when I was in some very interesting headspaces. And mm-hmm. I would catch myself and be like, dude, dial it back. But that's how immersive it is. And it's so immersive for me that by the time I was done, I felt differently about all the themes and issues I was writing about. I mean, they all still exist. I still have feelings about them, but they were so processed. So even though I said, don't do it, do it, because writing is the best therapy I have found.
It is. It is. It definitely is. What about the physical process? You and I are the same age. We met when we were 12 or 13.
I think 12. Yeah.
I think we were fucking 12. So that's a 40-year friendship now. Damn. That's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
I write with a pen and paper.
Whoa.
And then I transfer it to the computer for a submission or for whatever I'm going to do. You don't do that.
I have a question for you. When you said you transfer it, but is there a certain amount of editorial process that happens?
It goes
through another run, right? Yes. Through your brain. Yeah, mm-hmm. I figured. I write on the computer just because my handwriting and because I'm a pack rat and I like having more than one copy of something.
Your handwriting?
Well, we all, you know, have our burdens. That is something, man.
It's ridiculous. It's insane.
Like that's
the fact that I can read this is, I mean, I don't know. There are very few people who can read my handwriting.
My handwriting looks like I've written the name of my killer. that's what it looks like to me. But so I would rather cut than add. I don't like I don't like, oh, flesh this out and describe the room and all of this. So I just try to get it all out the first time and then cut as needed.
I remember on more than one occasion in college, I would be assigned a 10-page paper and I would hand in 2.5 and I would say, look, I can give you another 7.5 pages of filler if you want, but if this doesn't complete the assignment, I will give you some filler. And they were like, oh, shit, man, you did.
And that worked for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I can be very concise and I don't like to put in a bunch of bullshit just to make it 10 pages.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. And even so, Knucklehead's, I think, 340 pages long. And that was the most concise I could get what I was trying to say.
Mm-hmm. When I finished reading your book, I sent you a text.
Let me throw a little background out. The elevator pitch for Knucklehead was a young black law student inflicts his growing pains on late 80s New York and early 90s San Francisco. The book is published by Akashic Press. It launched in February, and it's available on Amazon and other fine stores.
And you're going to do that again at the end of the show. And, you know, I'm going to ask you, like, where we can find you, all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
I've been doing this for a while. Okay. we're gonna promote you. Okay. But good on you, because I'm guessing you've done other interviews where people didn't do that.
And you never know what actually, once it starts, it's a wild ride.
So. Mm-hmm. So this is what I wrote to you Tuesday, March 13th, 9:38 p.m. my time. And this is absolutely true, just finished reading Knucklehead. I was going to give you shit and act like I thought it was crap, but I know you wouldn't buy it because I think you know you have something damn good here, don't you?
I do now. I didn't know at first. I did not know. I knew I had done the best I could do. I didn't know how it would be received at all.
Okay. Adam, it's instantly engaging. I felt I was with you at damn near every turn of the page. I actually cried from your loss. Fuck you for that. And cheered for your wins. I, like too many people these days, have not been reading enough books. You jump-started my love of reading again. Thank you for that. A word of advice, because I've seen this so much. You're going to be famous. Be very selective in who you trust. Love and respect. And then you wrote, holy shit, dude! Hugs!
Yeah, it's always the author. Concise. Like you said, you know, you jump-started my love of reading is like the nicest thing I could hear about that.
It's true. And I... the first book I read after yours, I decided to go something light. And it's this book called Dominic. D-O-M-N-I-C. No K at the end. And it's essentially a children's book. And it's something I read when I was fairly young. And it's just beautiful. And I recommend it. Anyone looking for something light, even though it's a children's book, it still can speak to an adult. It spoke to me. I thought it was really fun. And then since I had enjoyed that, I looked at the books on my bookshelf and I saw Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And I was like, all right, let's stick with some children's stuff for now.
Wow.
And I opened it up. It's a first edition with the dust jacket.
Mm. On your shelf?
Yes.
Wow.
And those are going for, in the condition that it's in,
yeah,
about $5,000.
Yeah,
So I put that away.
Yeah, you put that in a baggie.
Yeah, bag that up.
Yeah.
Go to the library and get another copy of Charlie the Chocolate. So you jump-started my love for reading, and you led me to a book worth $5,000.
Woohoo!
Thank you for that.
That will happen to everyone who reads the book.
Yes, it will. Okay, now almost all of your reviews have been fantastic on Amazon, on Goodreads. And it's well deserved. I'm going to do a review of the two bad reviews.
Oh no! I don't read reviews, man. This will be new to me.
Oh really?
I try not.
Well, there are
to.
Only two bad ones.
I've read a couple of them.
Okay. How can you not?
Oh, it's easy.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, they're all super positive.
Oh, okay, I appreciate that.
Except this one.
Diana, 1 star. This is the author's debut novel, but I could not get into this one. Subject matter, characters, writing style, just not anything that appealed to me. Struggling to get to page 100, I finally decided to quit. I received this copy from Library Thing Giveaway for an honest review.
You didn't read the book!
Oh, no.
You got it for free, and you didn't read the book, and you give it 1 star? Bye, Felicia. That's my review of her review.
Yes, nice. Nice. Well done.
Okay, here's the second one. And I'm not even going to read the whole thing. And this is Addie. This is basically a novel that you would expect from an affluent black conservative living in California. The author, protagonist, is honestly a new black. What the hell is a new black?
Yeah. I'm new again.
Yeah.
I'm an affluent black conservative.
And can really afford to be one because he's an attorney. The description of this book is misleading. Okay, I'm not going to read the rest of
this. That was hate speech against attorneys right there.
But my review of this is, that's one way to get around a restraining order, Sarah.
Well played.
I knew you'd like that.
Well played, Sarah.
I knew you'd like that.
Oh, wow. Oh. You know what? This is true. I appreciate the fact of a reaction to the book. Like, I'm not necessarily going to read it. But if you like it, if you don't like it, it's still, you know, two sides of the same coin. I'd rather you like it. But if you don't like it because it triggered something in you or it made you think something, then you know, I don't think you can really ask for much more than that when you take thoughts out of your own head and put them on a page and give them to somebody else to read. I mean, everybody's not going to agree with you.
That's true.
Want everyone to agree with Marcus. I mean, that's the thing. She was like the author, protagonist, which I totally get, but I am grateful.
Sarah wrote that several times in her review.
I'm grateful for that reaction too, because I worked hard on it, you know? Mm-hmm.
So let's discuss this a little bit. It is not a memoir, but there are many traits of Marcus that are Adam. In what ways do you, I'm going to be more general than I was going to be before you lawyered up. In what ways do you view the differences between Marcus and Adam?
I think the primary difference is that Marcus lacks impulse control. That mm-hmm. let's say Marcus has 25% of the impulse control, or, you know, maybe even higher. Maybe a little goes a long way. Maybe it's one of those things like on a curve, right? So every point of impulse control, you act more and more consistent with expectations. So he tends to go with his impulses. Perhaps I tend to write about them. Big difference. The other difference is I now have the benefit of experience and age in the years that came after the span of the book, which, like I said, covers late 80s to early mid 90s. And those are big differences. He's a young man. I used to be a young man, but he still is.
Right. Yes. There was one chapter that after I read it, and Nancy, my sister, is reading it also. She actually bought me my copy. That was very nice. After I read it, I was like, every single thing that I've read here, even though I know it's not all true, a lot of it is probably not true, everything was believable.
Mm.
There was one chapter that was not believable. And I told this to Nancy. To me, anyway.
Okay.
Might not be to everyone.
Okay.
And I mentioned this to Nancy, and she goes, well, don't tell me what it is. And I said, I wasn't going to. The next time we had dinner, she goes, okay, I think I know what it is. And this was that without me giving her any hints whatsoever.
Okay.
It was the chapter...
Spoiler alert.
Yes.
Okay.
Spoiler alert.
Okay.
It was the chapter where you first met the parents of Amalia, and you describe your father's death very, very in great detail, and it's a very, very sad story. It tugs at your heart.
Wow. Okay, we're gonna go there.
Yeah, and then you said, "I lied." Neither you nor the character that you created would ever do that at first meeting of parents of someone that you loved. I just didn't find it believable.
Well, let me
ask
you,
what do you think
this
about that?
I understand you didn't believe it when you read it. Having read the entire book, if you were to revisit that behavior, would you see it differently? And it's
what do you mean?
Well, more is revealed. That's the outer layer of the onion.
More is revealed, yes. And I still don't see that character doing that.
And that's cool. Consider rereading it.
Okay. I did.
Okay.
I already did.
Okay. All right.
I did go back and I was like, I'm not. But
was there more context for it though after you read the whole
book? There is more context. Yes. Yes. But just because me and my sister, I mean, we both have known you for a long time.
Yes.
So, and we do see so much of you
yes.
in Marcus.
Yes.
So I think we're both like, Adam would never do that.
Well, but sure, Adam would never do plenty of that stuff.
Yes,
Marcus.
I believed a lot of the things.
Well, see, here's the thing about believability. I've seen people call memoir not believable. Believability and truth are two very different things, and writers learn that the hard way. You know, I've written memoir.
True.
And then people say, it's not believable. And you're like, but the shit happened. But it doesn't, mm-hmm. That doesn't translate to the words on the page. They don't glow if the shit actually happened. So you have to put that there.
Yes, you do. What writers inspire you?
A lot. And that's tricky, right? Because I'm going to leave somebody out. So I'm going to try to, I'll start with the heavies.
Okay.
I'll start with the heavies. James Baldwin, Richard Wright.
Oh, yes.
Maya Angelou's yes. Prose. I'm not really much of a poetry buff, but her memoir was everything. The 6 or 7 books worth. Chinua Achebe.
Who's that?
Things Fall Apart.
I'm not familiar.
You got to read that, man, because he takes what I call the worst thing that ever happened and makes it readable. A lot of people, man, they want to share their trauma with you, man. And some people really like that, but I've got enough damage. I don't need to like completely internalize other people's damage. There are some I've read some things I wish I hadn't. And there's nothing heavier than the stuff he writes about, but it's like you're sitting on a park bench and a man comes and sits down next to you and chats you up and you talk for like 3 hours and then he leaves and you're changed. That's what his books are like for me. A good friend of mine actually was part of the faculty at Bard with him. Bard, you can applaud if you want. And
but Simon's Rock.
And
Simon's Rockers actually are not all that keen on the Bard thing.
Oh.
Yeah. Like someone put a big banner on one of the dorms that said not Bard College.
Oh my!
Yeah, we think we're better than them.
Okay. Now I understand. I totally get that. Who else? So there are like the people that I was reading when I was growing up, and then there are the people who I was reading before I started writing, and I didn't know it, but I was kind of like loading up some foundation. I ate all of Walter Mosley's work up to that period of, you know, to the around the turn of the millennium, you know, late 90s, all of the 90s. I read a lot of Mosley. I read a lot of Jeff Nicholson, Junichiro Tanizaki. I didn't necessarily read the people everybody else read. I just kind of came by my stuff. Mm-hmm. And when I discovered, I mean, except for Mosley, who obviously has a lot of commercial appeal, I would discover a book and then just read everything they wrote. A lot of Malcolm.
Mm-hmm.
Read a lot of Malcolm.
What did you think of the film?
Malcolm X?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so good.
So good.
So I feel like that's what his Oscar was for. They give the delayed reaction Oscar sometimes.
Okay.
Like, I think The Departed was actually for Goodfellas.
Okay. All right.
And whatever with Training Day. I mean, Training Day was fine. But X? You fucking shitting?
I think it's a very important film.
Oh, my
God.
I think it's...
I hope you disagree with me on this. I think it's more important for white people to watch this than black people. And I'll tell you why. I think that the black community is already more educated on who Malcolm X really was and the changes that he went through. And white people think of him as just completely anti-white, militant.
I mean, that may be. I try not to think too much about what white people need to do to stop thinking the things that they think despite decades and centuries of evidence to the contrary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but yeah, I'm sure that would be helpful. Of course, those people would be the ones who would go to see it in the first place.
The people that already know, you think?
They might think they know.
Okay.
But they're still... I don't know.
I feel the same way about, I don't know if you've seen it, Panther.
Oh, Panther. Man, I haven't seen that in a while.
Powerful film.
Yeah. Yeah, and
also,
good.
Yeah. Also, you know, a lot of white people think about the Black Panther Party, and they don't remember the part where it says, for self-defense.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I mean, Knucklehead deals with that a lot. Part of the whole what really happened thing, you may have noticed at the reading the other day, I said, you know, well, people like to ask me what did or did not happen. And this next scene actually happened. And it was about when those LAPD officers were acquitted for a beating that we all watched on video.
Right.
And the shock of that. And it always strikes me that in the face of bombings, people can still focus on someone else raising their voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those two things come together when, you know, let's say a fella's doing something super scary like wearing a hoodie or holding a phone and he gets shot in the back 60 billion times and mm-hmm. and those actions are viewed as, you know, cause and effect or on par in some way, or I don't quite follow.
Mm-hmm.
I don't quite follow, but you know, that's not really my business.
I want to mention a little side note. This show, Art Star Scene Radio has been really silly for a long time and all about just the craziest things that are happening in the world and very sexual in nature. And I decided to do a serious episode, and I was nervous about it. I was really nervous about just getting in here and being serious with you. But I'm really glad that we've gone in this direction. I really enjoy it. There was another. Are you having fun?
I am. I just hope everybody listening is having fun and we're not just bringing them down.
I don't care.
All right, cool. Good.
No, I do care. But if you are listening for the first time and really enjoying this, don't listen to any back episodes. If you think this has value and you would like to support the station, go to radiofreebrooklyn.com/pledge. If you'd like to sponsor this show in particular and you think it has merit and it's worth sponsoring, go to rfb.nyc/ass. Yeah, really. Because it's Art Star Scene, so it's ASS.
I totally get that. I totally get that, but I was also thinking, don't worry, folks, that we'll be back to the butt stuff jokes next week.
Yes, we will. But maybe not, because there's like serious stuff that, I've done so much ridiculous stuff. And I know that my co-host, Catherine, she's got plenty of serious stuff. And
I'm sorry she's not here. That would have been cool.
I know. I think I might be wanting to take this in a different direction. We'll see.
All right.
Another case that you had discussed in your book was the O.J. Simpson case.
And the who now? The O.J.? I'm sorry?
And what a divisive time. Or not a divisive time. What a time where it showed the divide.
Yes.
I needed to reword that.
Yes.
Because those feelings were there. And when the verdict was announced and when black people were celebrating and white people were just empty, it seemed, that's when we saw a divide that was always existing. And I'm really glad that you dealt with this and the way you did, because I'd always said pretty much what you said. He's guilty, but the evidence wasn't there. And the black community was not fooled. It was a celebration of saying, we saw this trial, there wasn't enough evidence. It wasn't collected properly, and it wasn't presented properly. You can't convict, and if you did, it's an injustice, and they saw justice. And I
would even say it wasn't a celebration, it was relief.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're going to be the most famous, beloved black person in America and rich, and Johnny Cochran is your lawyer, and cops get caught committing perjury on the stand and you still get convicted, then there's no hope for any of us. So just because OJ got off didn't mean anybody else was going to get a fair trial, but it, at least...
Didn't they draw his blood at his house instead of at a lab or at a precinct and then say, well, there was all kinds of things that were just done wrong.
Yeah.
It might not have been that... I might be wrong about that, but there was something about the way his blood was handled that was wrong.
Perhaps if we had that trial today, it would go differently.
How so?
More to people's satisfaction. I think that over time, a certain segment is learning that their actions don't have to make nearly as much sense as they thought they did. You can just do it. You can just do it. Just kill the guy and then say, yeah, we killed him. And then that's kind of it. Then, you know, somebody will say something on an awards show and it's over. There have been so many lynchings, I can't even keep up.
Mm.
I'm still stuck on all the 90s ones. That's why I wrote about them.
I wanted to bring this up.
One of the lines,
but go ahead.
Spoiler alert, at one point Marcus says that O.J. Simpson could have cut off a black woman's head on video and it would have never gone to trial and you wouldn't even remember. I think that's relevant.
That is relevant. Would you read a little excerpt? Anything you want.
Oh.
I brought it with me.
You brought it? Oh, see, I didn't bring mine, so I could even, be like, sorry, I don't.
I come prepared. Even though I'm suggesting people read the book before they listen to this episode, there's something about hearing an author read their work the intonations. You're an excellent reader, and I would appreciate that.
You know what? If I can find the one I want to do, yeah, I think here it is. Here it is. Oh, yeah, this is pretty sweet. It's not that long. This will take about 5 minutes tops.
Perfect.
So, as I stated in the elevator pitch, Marcus starts off as a law student. This is called No, You Probably Can't. Monday, August 6th, 1990. It was the week before any classes started anywhere at NYU. The law school had taken over one of the undergraduate dorms, a massive apartment building on Bleecker, for law firm first round interviews. Rather than all of us taking time out of our studying during the school year to beat the bushes and law firm partners taking time out of their billing to recruit, we all came together under one roof each year before classes began for a huge interview orgy. The orgy imagery was made no less apt by the fact that each desk in the room was 3 feet from a bed. If you and your credentials made it past this initial hurdle, the next round or two of interviews were much more likely to yield an offer. It was very efficient. So that was the situation. There was no other activity taking place. The entire building was being used for one purpose, job interviews. It was filled with two kinds of people. One, young people in blue suits, and two, old people in blue suits. That's it. I wasn't messing around. I had 8 half-hour interviews booked for the first day alone. Baby's first briefcase was stuffed with resumes and transcripts and references and writing samples. I was rocking a navy pinstripe three-piece and wingtips. I was rested, caffeinated, and not too gassy. I was ready. My morning went well enough at first. I made my little speeches and tried to get used to the half-hour format, which back then seemed like a very long interview. I learned where to linger and where to keep it moving. I got better at making my face appear interested, like Arsenio. I was making moves. Then my 11:30 happened. It was 11:29. I knocked on the closed dorm room door and opened when I heard a grunt. Wedged behind the tiny desk was a large middle-aged gentleman stuffed into a blue suit. It was a nice suit, but because it didn't cover the man's face, his Boston was showing. I was trying to figure out how to make that work in my favor as I smiled warmly and said, "Mr. O'Donnell?" Mr. O'Donnell did not smile back. He didn't glare either. He just looked at me. "Can I help you?" he said. When I think back on this moment, me now wishes that me then had answered, "No, you probably can't. Thank you for your time," and turned my back on the inappropriate racist some firm had seen fit to send to a top five law school. Me then could have used the reclaimed time to bounce back from that bit of surreality and rest up and practice and go into his remaining interviews with renewed vigor. That is certainly what me now would do today, knowing what I know now, what I had only then suspected or feared. But my next thought is, had I done that, perhaps I wouldn't even be me now. Maybe that would have been a mistake. Maybe the man was legally blind and thought that the blue of my three-piece was actually a jumpsuit and that I was making rounds emptying trash cans. Or maybe the angry Irish gentleman would have been offended by my militant self-respect and complained about me to the school, blackballing me. Or maybe it was some sort of test and it was actually a grade firm. I just didn't know. I couldn't know. And so the second thought me now has is great admiration for me then, for being prudent and taking the high road and not shooting off the retort I have carried around for 25 years, but rather saying, sweetly, "I am Marcus Hayes. I'm here for my 11:30 interview." And upon getting absolutely nothing in return, taking tentative steps to the ugly chair on the other side of the desk and sitting on the edge of it and having a little staring contest, and upon realizing that the man was never, ever going to commence the interview, commencing it myself and asking the big red face questions about the firm and receiving yes or no grunts and head gestures for the full 30 minutes before thanking Mr. O'Donnell and backing slowly out of the room.
Thank you, Adam.
And yeah, that happened.
That happened.
For anyone interested in that side of things, yeah, that's totally
okay. All right, I am gonna be silly for a little while.
Cool.
Stephen Botchko passed away recently.
Yeah.
And he was the creator of many shows, one of which was NYPD Blue.
Woohoo.
So for tonight's top 10 list, this is the top 10 Oh, give me a moment. I had it here.
I will do some Stephen Bochco theme music while you look. Da 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 da.
Thank you.
Da 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 da.
There we go.
All right.
Okay, this is the top 10 NYPD Blue episode titles that could be porn. That could be porn. And if any type of porn comes to your mind, feel free to shout it out.
Okay.
Number 10, Honeymoon at Viagra Falls. I don't even know where to go with that.
Self-explanatory.
One. But there's some like elderly. That's some elder porn and right there.
These are real. These are real.
Yeah, these are all real episode titles.
All right, bring it.
Number 9, Chatty Chatty Bang Bang.
Oh, that's sweet. I don't even want to know what that would be.
I think that's just someone who's too talkative during sex.
And it's starring Dick Van Dyke, like nice. The original. Yeah. I think I have that one.
Number 8, Nude Awakening.
Yeah, that's pretty straightforward.
I think that's like you just woke up somewhere nude and just shouldn't have been there. Damn it.
The whole video is just a walk of shame.
Number 7, Remembrances of Humps Past.
Oh, dear.
I think that's just masturbation porn. Just,
a lot of flashbacks, like old school 70s porn.
There you go. Yeah. Now you're getting into
yeah.
it. Number 6, Bottoms Up.
There you go.
Number 5, Hose Down.
Oh, oh, wow. Damn.
Number 3. Number 4, Porn Free. That's just the internet.
Yeah.
Number 3, Tranny, Get Your Gun.
Oh, dude.
Number 2, and this isn't even number 1. This is the actual episode title, Hand Job.
Wow.
I feel happy.
I remember I walked out of that one because there were no hand jobs.
The number 1 episode title of NYPD Blue that could be porn. In the Butt, Bob.
Oh.
Do you know what that's from?
Almost. It's refresh my memory.
Newlywed Game.
Yes! You're the strangest place you've made whoopee.
That be in the butt, Bob.
Yes. Beautiful. Beautiful. Old school reference.
You're the ones that didn't quite make the list. Old Man Quiver.
Oh.
One in the Nuts. Better Laid Than Never. Low Blow. And Brown Appetit.
Oh. NYPD Blue indeed. Rest in peace, Mr. Bochco.
I noticed on your Facebook page you had you had a post about the All in the Family theme song.
Oh yeah.
And how almost every line is offensive.
I just woke up. I don't know what I was dreaming, but I woke up and I heard that. Oh no, somebody mentioned it. I was at a reading the night before and somebody made a passing reference to either Archie Bunker or All in the Family. And so that my brain is such that I woke up having played that song in like, high def or whatever, and for I don't know how many hours of my sleep. And I woke up just meditating on the words and how it's just one long dog whistle. And I didn't think twice about it when it was, when I was, a kid watching the show and guys like us, we had it made. I was like, oh, okay. Then they're going to make America great again now, aren't they? I've gotten that sparked a conversation about whether the show was satirical. I always assumed it was. I always assumed Archie Bunker was an exaggerated caricature of a certain kind of person that Norman Lear wanted to put out for the world to see. Other people have told me they always thought of it as he was just the face of it. And it was like double reverse irony. Norman Lear's politics, notwithstanding, that he was just straight up saying the things, and people who agreed with him dug it. And he was a rallying point for what is now, Roseanne, I guess.
Okay, what do you think of the new Roseanne?
I didn't think much of the old Roseanne, so I haven't watched it.
Okay,
I hear that they have both. What's the name? Begins with a D. The daughter. Darlene. Mm-hmm. They have both Darlenes. Yes. So I appreciate that. Because that's always kind of fucked up when they just swap. My personal trauma is Lionel, but I can understand if somebody, you know, if it goes back all the way to Darren for somebody, or I'm sure there's a whole generation of mm-hmm. people who got kind of weirded out by the Darlene thing. But
what do you feel about, because in both cases, Roseanne, but they brought her back, and All in the Family, a major character was killed off.
Ooh.
Edith died.
Yes.
And
spoiler alert.
Dan died.
Yeah.
Writers that create these characters that people love and then kill them off. I was thinking about when I first started creating characters, there was a girl in my building. Her name was Sally Button. Like, can you have a cuter
wow.
name? And we met, she was in, you know, there's a courtyard in my
yeah.
building, and she was walking duck footed. And I had been doing that myself because I was pigeon toed.
Mm.
So I had to do these exercises where I walked duck footed. And so that's how we first like met and bonded. She was about a year older than me. And we started hanging out all the time. We played all the time. And we would create characters. We'd go into her closet and her parents' closet and put on these different clothes. And like, I still remember her like duck footing, walking with the oversized shoes on. And
she was the first art star.
I guess so. At about age, I don't think I've ever told you about this. What she succumbed to childhood leukemia.
Mm.
And this was my first experience with loss.
Mm.
I was probably 7.
Dude, that's young, man.
And the thing about this story is it's not true. I just created this character, Lucy Buttons, and killed her off just now. And I even got some tears going.
Oh, he did.
I did.
He did. He was sitting here. No, and I'm looking at him.
Why do we do this? Why do writers do this?
Yeah, but don't you feel good? Don't you feel good? Yeah.
I almost got you crying a little bit.
Yeah, I was like, oh, Sally Buttons.
Sally Buttons. I give her all these little characteristics, the duck walk, all of it.
Oh, my God. And the little outfits.
The outfit and the big shoes.
Oh, wow. That was brutal, man.
What's wrong with me?
That was brutal.
I know.
But the shit works, though.
It works. You cared about her.
I remember when I first read, and here's another spoiler alert, first read Dune. That shit blew my mind because, you know, and I'm sorry, I'm going to blow this, but I was a kid and I'm reading this book and it's sci-fi and it's real cool. And then basically, like, everybody dies.
Mm-hmm.
And that shit just starts over. And mm-hmm. I'm like, you can do that?
I remembered something from, I think this was the first year we were friends. Do you remember our fake fight?
Vaguely.
We choreographed the whole fucking thing. Like slamming my head onto the hood of the car because I knew how to do that move where you hit your hands there and you bring your head back.
Yeah.
So it sounds like your head just actually hit the car.
Yeah.
We choreographed a fight.
That's beautiful.
And of course everybody was getting all around us. Ooh, fight, 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 fight. Because people didn't break up fights back then.
No. In fact, there were fights. My understanding is that that's not a thing anymore. But no, every other 3 o'clock, there was something on the bill.
Mm-hmm.
In the school. It wasn't us, but just, you know, fights were a thing, man. That was part of our entertainment.
Yeah. Yeah, there was definitely a throwing against a fence. I remember that part.
Nice.
And there was some fake punches where, like, you would like fake like you were punching and I would do the slap sound.
Did you get any shots in?
Yeah, I got a few shots
okay,
in.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah, we made it a fair fight.
Yeah.
We made it kind of because it was going back and forth.
Nice.
But the final shot was the slamming the head against there.
Oh.
And then I went down and then I got up and I remember you going, "We fooled all y'all." I'm surprised we didn't get our asses kicked for doing
it. No, absolutely. That's amazing. We did a lot of shit, man. We were crazy.
Yeah, yes, we did.
And even when I mentioned orgies in that little passage I read, you know, orgies. If I recall correctly, it was our first conversation. We were fucking 12.
Yeah.
And we were comparing notes about all the orgies we'd been to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, none many.
Right. Were there was there ginger ale at your orgy? Yeah, yeah. That was totally soda at my orgy. Oh, cool, cool.
Yeah, I mean, I remember you mentioning after the last show.
Yeah.
And now we've done that crazy shit.
Yeah.
We'll move on. Are you still in touch with the parents of the Amalia's character?
But they're not real.
They're not real.
So, because it's a novel. So, they're in my head.
Okay.
They're in my head. It's, you know, as much as I appreciate that thin line, I'm wary of it. A friend of mine wrote a novel around 2000. It was a novel. I looked at the cover. It says, a novel. Took shit for not being an underage, gender fluid truck stop prostitute. Like when people were like, oh shit, it was written by a writer, people lost their minds. So it can even go both ways. Like, is this true or is this false? And that's cool, but I know somebody who knows that it can be not cool. So.
But when your character is an attorney and a black belt, and you're an attorney and a black belt, and you know, so many obvious similarities.
It's just a glaring lack of imagination. That's all. Next book, I'm gonna eat my Wheaties, and it'll be about like a talking dragon or some shit, some wizards.
Do you actually have ideas for your next book?
Oh yeah, talking dragon, who goes around fucking people up on the street. After graduating from law school.
After being a successful novelist.
Yes. Wizards.
Author. How is the book doing?
It's too soon to say as far as sales go, but I wrote this book on the condition to myself that when it was perfect, I would put it in a drawer. And when I died and they were throwing out my shit, someone would find it and read it and go, oh, we should have been nicer to him. He was a good writer. And then at some point, you know, 5 years in, I was like, you don't work this hard on something without hoping someone reads it. And then that's, you know, shit was serious by then. But each new milestone is a pleasant surprise. Because writing is hard and largely thankless, and you know, I'm certain there are more lottery winners than rich, successful authors. And so the idea that it resonated for my friends was a victory. And then when it resonated for my agent, at Upstart Crow Literary, the Danielle Ciotti, the first person in the industry who got what I was doing, that was a victory. That was, and even at that point, that was my personal goal. Like, get an agent, because that part was up to me. The rest of it was up to the agent and all the rest of that. So then we got a publisher eventually. We got the perfect publisher eventually, and expectations have been exceeded since then. The good reviews, SF Chronicles review was spot on. I did read that, and I really, really dug it.
Yeah, when I say reviews, when it's like from Goodreads and it's just some guy.
Right. There's a hierarchy, right? And yeah. I'm really starting to appreciate that. And in the beginning, I was like, you know, who the fuck is a critic? But a critic is still a step up from the people whose voices you did so well.
Thank you for that. So there was going to be an entire Did You Really Do It? Which at the top of the show we discussed, you lawyered up on.
There too.
But there are a couple of things that we okay. are going to see.
All right.
So, did you really fuck up that poet's reading?
No, I did not fuck up. And there are some spoilers here, but I did not fuck up the reading by the young griot who was singing the praises of his ancestors who jumped off of the slave ships. Yeah, Marcus points out those aren't his ancestors because they jumped off the ships
right.
and they took their babies with them.
That's why I was laughing.
No, totally. Because
that could have been really inappropriate.
No, you were laughing because you thought that was funny. I did a long time ago hear somebody make a similar speech, but I didn't raise my hand and heckle. Black Panther is everything to me. The one thing I kind of snagged on, and I'm not, okay, that comes up. Let's just say that concept comes up. And I get it. I think that a slight rewrite, you could express that sentiment, you know, kind of your spiritual ancestors or your would-be ancestors. Mm-hmm. But I do think it takes something away from the people who survived, who endured and survived.
We had talked about this beforehand, and you said it was sort of a composite.
Yeah, it was the times I've heard that.
Okay.
And the thoughts I've had in response, and I was able to actually, you know, through the magic of literature, create a scenario where that conversation actually happens in real time, as opposed to, you know, in three or four snippets over 20 years.
Okay. Now, you had already told me that you didn't actually ever wake up with a gun on your face.
That's true.
But my follow-up question did intrigue you, which was, what was your impetus for creating that scenario?
Knucklehead is about the ups and downs of life and rises and falls and twists and turns. You know, life is short. I agree that life is short, but I also think that life is long. And in a life well-lived, perhaps, one finds oneself in various situations, various extreme situations that not only they wouldn't expect, but you couldn't even necessarily reconcile with each other. Because in the course of life, you try different things and you're young and you live here and you meet this person, you meet that person. Different parts of ourselves come out when we're in relationships with different people. And as a result of a confluence of circumstances and personalities and bad luck, yeah, Marcus wakes up with a gun in his face.
Okay. We only have 7 minutes left to the show, less than 7 minutes. Can you tell us where people can find your book and upcoming readings and anything else that is pertinent to promoting this shit?
Upcoming readings. I should have brushed up on my calendar. I've just done a bunch of really good events, from the launch in Berkeley in February to KGB Bar the other day. You were there. You took one of the best pictures of the thing. Back in the Bay Area.
Thank you.
I will be at Octopus Literary May 4th. I will be at Writers with Drinks in July. That's in San Francisco. And I'm thinking about announcing a date. I think you're about to get a scoop.
Nice. I like that.
I have been asked to participate in the Open Book Festival in September in Cape Town, South Africa.
Wow.
So I'm going to Africa to talk about Knucklehead.
Wow. Congratulations.
Thanks, bro.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Wow.
So we talk about expectations being exceeded. I mean,
wow.
Yeah, Africa, man. Africa, Africa, as Dave Chappelle put it.
When you mentioned writing this book and like not publishing it and someone finds it someday, did you know that I made an album?
I don't know that I knew that.
Because I buried it. I did. It was, I think, 1992. And I just resurrected it. It can be found. I can't remember where to tell people where to find it. But I remember that I made this album, and I thought it was really awesome. And I had shopped it to like maybe two record labels. I didn't work it that hard at all.
Yeah, yeah.
And they weren't interested. And then I did a show with the musicians, and I was terrible. They were great. I was terrible. But I was like, well, this just didn't work, you know? So I successfully shelved it. 24 years later, I dig it up and I listen to it, and it's fucking amazing.
Yeah, I was going to say, man, I bet the shit's not bad.
It's fucking incredible.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And so I'd had one episode. I had it converted to a CD.
Yeah.
And I did an episode of Art Star Scene Radio, which was just the album, listening to the album. And then afterwards, Catherine, my co-host, giving me so much shit for not releasing it. She's like, you idiot.
Yeah.
You would have been a rock star.
Dude, I bet it was so good. See, this is the thing.
Really
going back in junior high school, this is who we were. I was the kid who got in trouble for laughing at the shit Face said under his breath.
That's true.
I couldn't stay quiet about it. So, yeah, you get a good band behind you, man. And
oh, it was incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, I got to hear that.
Yeah, yeah, you do. How do you feel about your CD, Justice, looking back on it now?
You know, it's all been the same stuff, man. I've been trying to say the same one goddamn thing for as long as I can remember. And this this novel is the medium, the time and place that has resonated the most for people.
Mm-hmm.
But it all counts. You know, the line I said about OJ could have cut off a black woman's head and you wouldn't even remember.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the lines in the CD.
Okay.
So this has been rattling around for a minute.
Yeah, it has. You can find me at faceboy.com. You can hear all past episodes of Art Star Scene Radio there. And there are links to different things that I do. And I do want to mention coming up next on Radio Free Brooklyn is Get Rich Quick with Josh and Noel. Do you like money?
Yes.
I'm sure you do. Do you like to laugh? Of course you do. So stay tuned for Get Rich Quick with Josh and Noel.
Shit, that sounds good.
Wasn't that good?
Yeah.
I'm selling it.
I like to laugh.
And you like money.
I like money.
Oh, sorry. It's the show. I like to do that sometimes. I like to do purposeful dead air.
It's time for the dead air segment.
2.5 minutes. I know goes quickly, so I do a little bit of music with it. I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me. Face, you are a force of nature, man. You've been at this a long time in so many different forms. One of the benefits of 40 years of friendship is you see almost the entire body of work, you know? And by work, I just mean your life.
I appreciate
that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get down on myself a lot. And then I think about it and I realize everything I've set out to do, I've succeeded in.
Yeah.
You know, I get down on myself because I'm not rich.
Right.
Because I don't have the monetary things that, you know, the measures of that society tells you measure yourself by. But I wanted to do a radio show. I'm doing a fucking great one. It's usually the most downloaded one on the station. Wanted to do an open mic. It became famous. It was written in the New York Times.
You know what it is? It's like there are two layers of success. There's rich and famous, and we like that one. But then there's the one where 50 years from now, when you die, someone is going to say to someone you don't know, oh, you know who died? Faceboy. And that person you never met is going to go, like they're going to know. They're going to give a shit. Like maybe if I'm lucky, 50 years from now when I die, they're going to be like, you know who died? Adam Smyre. Huh? He wrote Knucklehead. And somebody's going to go, And that's something.
No, you're going to be a famous writer.
Well, we'll see.
Now, like soon. I know. I think it was you that told me that when we were in junior high school, I said Robert Downey Jr., his face is going to be, his poster is going to be on
teenage girls' walls.
I said that in junior high.
You called that shit.
I know. I see talent.
Wow, that's true.
Mm-hmm. So get ready, man.
All right.
Tune in each and every Saturday at 7 p.m. for Art Star Scene Radio. Oh, fuck. This is important.
You have 11 seconds.
Yeah, this is a common household item that was recently recalled. It could kill you
if
you don't take care of this.